Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to the Rainbow Players about the performances coming up of the production Over the Hill, Under the Rainbow. And we're going to be speaking to Marty Rosenberg about vintage and rare jazz posters, which is an exhibition that's coming up. Right now, I'd like to welcome Susan Gardner. She's an artist and author of a new book of poetry called Caja de Luz, Box of Light, published by Red Mountain Press. And she will be speaking at Garcia Street Books today at 5 in the afternoon, where there will be a reading and book signing and little party over there. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you have published this bilingual book of poetry, Spanish and English, facing pages. What's your native language?
English.
English. And so when did Spanish come into your life?
Well, in the mid-1980s, I went to live in Mexico, and I arrived there with 10 weeks of Spanish class, not very fluent. In fact, we're in a restaurant. My first day in Mexico, I went to a restaurant, and I asked for lunch, el pescador, and that's a fisherman, and instead of a fish.
You asked for a fisherman. That's probably what they thought you wanted.
And I realized that in Spanish, as the other languages I had learned, I would do better to make a fool of myself than to keep quiet, so I learned Spanish.
And so, did you start reading poetry in Spanish? Were you writing poetry in English at that time?
I've written poetry, I guess, all my life without realizing I was a poet. I've always thought of myself only as a visual artist, and I realized I had been keeping a journal for 30 years in poetry. And some of these poems come from those observations or ideas that I wanted to explore.
And so did you start then listening to the cadence of Spanish and thinking about it in that way?
I didn't think of it as poetry at first, but I did from the very beginning very much enjoy speaking Spanish and learning Spanish and hearing it. It has a beautiful, beautiful sound to it. And any new language gives you a new way of thinking about things. It's not just new words. It's a whole way of thinking about things. So I had already learned Korean and Japanese and some French and a little tiny bit of Italian. When I came to Spanish, I lived for a while in Mexico City and then in a country town. And I had a lot of friends there. It happened, who were writers. We used to meet together on Sunday afternoon for lunch around 2-3 o'clock, and then we'd read to each other. And I learned to love Spanish and Mexican and Argentinian and Chilean poets through that group.
So when you wrote this book, Caja de Luz, did you write in English and translate into Spanish or vice versa or some of both?
Some of both. Some of these poems started as an idea a long time ago, and some were brand new.
So what is the difference for you in your process and also in what actually comes out when you start the poem in Spanish versus when you start it in English?
What the process is? Well,
I mean, I think writing a poem in a foreign language, I mean, lots of people do it, but I think it'd be different than what you draw on when you draw on your native language.
I think so, partly because in a new language, Spanish or any other new language, you don't have the depth of the depth of illusion that is when you write a poem. In your native language, you probably draw on all the literature you've ever read in your whole life and anything that you've heard and all the emotional content that you had even from your childhood or young college days.
Right, right.
But you don't have all of that in a new language that you learned as an adult. My children do because they learn Spanish young, but for me, I learned Spanish when I was an adult. And so all of it feels like an adventure.
And so, well, why don't you, would you like to read a poem or two in what? Well, let's start in English and then you can read the Spanish one as well.
Okay. This is Box of Light. At 6 in the afternoon, the air is heavy with sun, filled with intimations of the coming evening, still holding a lovely light, a motionless moment. I put my memories of the future in this box of light.
And then the Spanish version, Caja de Luz. This is the title, not title track, title poem of the book.
A las 6 de la tarde, el aire está pesado de sol, lleno de insinuaciones de la noche que se acerca. Sostiene todavía una luz feliz, un momento inmóvil. Pongo mis recuerdos del porvenir en esta caja de luz.
So it's so interesting. Now, did you write that poem in English first or in Spanish?
It began with an idea that's in the poem that's in Spanish.
So the translation is such a... Because, so, you know, lleno de insinuaciones de la noche que se acerca. You didn't translate insinuations from insinuaciones. You did intimations. And there's always those choices of whether to use a cognate or not.
Actually, the line you picked actually started in English first. A lot of times, as you start to come to a new language, a different idea will evolve, or a different aspect of that idea, because the language gives you a framework to think about it differently. And intimaciones is no such word.
Right.
So if you have intimations, you have to suggest something else that brings you the idea of a suggestion of something coming.
And with Spanish, the languages in some ways are so similar compared to other languages that you've learned, like Japanese, where you probably have very few or no cognates. Mm-hmm. So you're always working with the ways in which words have similar or not quite or dissimilar shades of meaning when they're from the same root.
Well, I think in Spanish, one of the things that guided me the most was to try and bring the sound in the sense of how that sound evokes that feeling in you. I wasn't very interested in exact translation, but more to evoke the same sensibility.
We're talking to Susan Gardner. So have you being here in Santa Fe, studied or worked with New Mexican Spanish?
Well, actually, I have. In fact, in this book, there is a poem that only could exist in New Mexico, because this word only exists in New Mexico. And Virga doesn't appear any place in the Spanish-speaking world except our little corner of it.
Virga.
Virga.
What does it mean, first of all?
Virga is the rain that we see in the sky that never comes to the ground. And in English it says, shy rain in the sky, falling toward us, hesitating, darkening the dusty day. And in Spanish it says, lluvia tímida en el cielo, cae hacia nosotros, vacilante, oscureciendo el día polvoroso. And by the way, this word polvoroso is also only in New Mexico. I didn't know that until very recently. My Spanish editor said she had never heard it till she moved here.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
But polvo is a word.
Yes.
It means powder or dust.
And in Mexico you say polvoso.
Ah, okay.
But you don't say polvoroso, but it fits much better in this poem.
In the meter. Very interesting. So you also are an artist, or you're first an artist, I guess.
Yes.
And you have would you call them illustrations or artworks that sort of go with the poems?
None of them were meant to be illustrations exactly. It just seemed like that made a nice rhythm in the book.
And what is the nature of the illustrations? Are they pen and ink drawings?
They're all made with sumi brushes called a fude and sumi ink.
So that's your Japanese influence?
In these drawings, I almost always prefer to draw with ink and a brush.
So you use other media, though, as well. Your previous book is all sorts of different artistic media.
Yes. Stone Music is a book that at the beginning kind of summarizes my career and shows older work and then progresses to poetry and more contemporary work.
Do you want to read a piece from that, from Stone Music?
Surely. I'll read you a poem that's kind of dear to me. That day, if you knock your elbow against the edge of the door, the funny bone will send a thrill of shock right to your brain. On that hot morning, our eyes knocked. In that instant, every bone was funny, every muscle laughing, every hair breathless. In the aftershock, I kept touching that electric pane, leaning against the door frame until my heart could move again.
Now, I see that piece is from 1984. This is a book of work that spans a long period of time.
Yes.
Have you always worked in very short form?
Yes, there are a few poems that are about twice this length, but that's still very few words. Many of my poems are only 15 or 20 words.
Why do you work in such a short form?
I think I'm interested in trying to see as accurately as possible what's right in front of me. And so I try to slice the moment transparently, and that's all that fits in that moment.
We were talking before we went on the air about sort of the state of poetry today, and you said something that was interesting to me, which is there's not enough poetry. Is there not enough poetry? Is there not enough accessible poetry, venues for poetry? Where are we at with poetry these days?
Well, I think I wouldn't want to broadcast myself as a major expert on the entire world of poetry, but in my observation, poetry is something that people really crave. I believe they want it, they crave it, they respond to it. But we've had a long period where poetry is existing on a couple of different levels, and a great deal of published poetry is simply written for other poets with a lot of reference to things that are academically interesting but don't connect to the audience in a very direct way. And I think that poetry is like any other art form. It serves people's need. People want to think about things in different artistic forms. We all have, as a species, we have since the time we lived in caves, and we probably will go on doing it as long as we exist. And as individuals, as well as society, we need art, and we need the things that art brings us, a way of thinking about things that's outside our immediate selves. A lot of poetry that's been published in the last 25 or 30 years is very, very much about the capital letter I, and not very much about the world that's out there. And we were also talking about the kind of new poetry that's coming up in some of the big cities, maybe even in our own town, where young people are beginning to talk about the things that are important to them, but using poetry to do it.
And there's some very powerful examples of that.
Yes, and some of it is really, truly wonderful. I had the opportunity, and I say opportunity advisedly, to experience this for myself in Española, and even young kids in junior high can produce wonderful art and terrific poetry. And they don't need much. They just need pencils and someone listening.
And probably a few examples of other poetry.
If you will allow me, I'll read you one.
Okay.
That is just about this subject. And it's called Making a Poem. Words heard before, sounds spoken in another time, nothing at all becomes something. Mystery upon magic, someone is listening.
Susan Gardner is an artist and author of the new book of poetry, Caja de Luz, Box of Light, which is published by Red Mountain Press, and she will be speaking at Garcia Street Books today at 5 in the afternoon. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Chris Lynn and Jean Simonoff. They are with the Rainbow Players, who are going to be putting on two performances of the production Over the Hill, Under the Rainbow. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So Over the Hill, Under the Rainbow is, what would you call it, an ensemble production of Reader's Theater. What is Reader's Theater?
Well, it means you're reading from a script. You're not memorizing. It's not staged. You don't have blocking and scenes, sets and costumes.
It's like a semi, what they call stage reading, but not, it's just a reading, essentially.
It is, but it is definitely dramatized.
So this is all going to be at Rainbow Vision, and it's all people who are residents at Rainbow Vision?
No, we're not. Actually, I'm not.
I'm not.
And Jean's not, yeah. It's funny that both of us, neither one of us are, the rest are.
And it's not happening here. It's happening at the...
It is. It's happening at Rainbow Vision, the Starlight Lounge, which is the bar they manage
there. Oh, okay. And then later on, there will be, in August, a production again at the Unitarian Church.
Right. Exactly.
So let's talk about... I mean, this is a not a play, but a series of readings about growing up gay and lesbian. Is it all drawn directly from the readers' lives, or is there some fiction in it as well?
Not really. I think it's all drawn from our lives, and our lives not just now, but our lives growing up and coming out. I know for myself, I came out at 19. That would have been 1959. So it takes place during our lives, coming to grips with it and talking about the things that have been important to us in our lives and what is different about us and what's similar to everybody else.
And I think the point that one of you made when we were talking about this beforehand was that there is, the coming out thing is a phenomenon unto itself, but the falling in love thing is something that appeals to gay, straight, and other audiences.
Right, exactly. It is. It's a lot of what we write about has broad appeal. You know, it has a perspective. It has a coloring because we're gay and lesbian. But we share a lot of life experiences with everyone.
So when you were, Jean, coming out in 1959 at the age of 19, I mean, that was a moment when gay and lesbian identity was just simply not talked about in American culture at all. Where did you find the strength and the knowledge to put words to what you were and what you wanted?
Well, I think for the first time in my life, I felt comfortable with myself having met a woman and falling in love just as everybody else would throughout their life. I know for me, back in 1959, my partner at the time, Sue, and I could have been arrested for even dancing together or being together in a bar.
You could have been arrested for dancing
sure.
together?
Sure.
Really? Did
it was
that
against
happen?
The law. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Where did you live?
I lived in Los Angeles. You know, we lived in L.A. And we went to private clubs at night, most of which were owned by cops and had the protection. You know, you pay a cover charge, you get in, and you were protected. And if at any point somebody walked in that could have been like an FBI agent or another cop or something, they would flash lights. And then you would switch. You could dance with a guy.
And so there were, this was a mixed club. It wasn't just a women's
right,
club.
Right.
And was that sort of the norm so that you could do that switching?
Sad but true, yeah.
So what was at stake for you? Were you worried about family rejection and things like that?
Oh, that happened. That definitely happened. I guess what was at stake was not being truly myself. If I didn't, you know, belong in this relationship, you know, if I didn't live who I was, what was at stake would be a hidden life. Which, of course, at work, you know, you didn't come out of work, you could lose your job.
Well, that's one of the themes in this whole set of pieces, Over the Hill Under the Rainbow, is pretty much everybody had to live a double life at a certain point.
Correct.
What about you, Chris?
Well, I was a much later bloomer. I came out in 82. So I was 35 when I came out. And by that time, things were a little easier.
Did you not know until then, or did you just sort of keep it?
Well, I was kind of ignorant. I say in one of the pieces that I write that I really didn't consciously start living until I was 28. You know, I think I just wasn't aware. You know, Adrienne Rich wrote a little monograph called Compulsory Heterosexuality. I think many of us experienced that, you know. Everyone was heterosexual, so we just did it because it was the norm.
Got married, had children.
Yeah, and I did that. And, you know, I was always had some feelings, but I didn't connect with them. And then for me, it was really a political decision. I came out at a time when the feminist movement was growing. My emotional, social relationships were with women. And it just seemed like a natural thing to make it a whole relationship.
Where were you living at that point?
I was living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And by that time, was there a community?
Well, yes, there was. Oh, we had a great organization called Hurricane Productions. And we produced women's music, comics like Kate Clinton, singers like Alex Dopkin, who's an early lesbian writer-singer. And so it was a great way to meet other lesbians and get involved, you know, and do everything from stage managing to PR to, you know, we had mailing parties and things like that. And so that's the way I actually met women in Milwaukee. Before that, I really didn't know it. I thought I didn't know any lesbians, but, you know, the fact is we all know people who are gay and lesbian, but, you know, they're not always out.
Right, exactly. So how has we talk about, you know, every group of everything is a community, quote unquote. What is the gay lesbian community like now compared to, say, 1982 or 1959? I mean, it's a huge difference since the 50s and 60s.
Oh, I think absolutely it is. Fortunately for us here in Santa Fe, we have a community like Rainbow Vision that I can say I've been here 15 years now, and it's the first time we've really had a cohesive gay, lesbian, transgender, you know, bisexual community where people could go and feel safe. You know, of course, there's hate crimes. I mean, we see things in the paper where guys are, you know, beat up and things like that happen. But it's so much more open. There's so many more options for kids today. And there's organizations like PFLAG, where you have parents and significant others that are supportive of their children, you know, are supportive of the community. I mean, if they'd had that when I was a kid, that would have been wonderful, instead of having to be, you know, my own alienation unto myself. You know, the community is more open. The religious institutions, I belong to Temple Beth Shalom, and our Rabbi Schwab is very open to gays and lesbians. We had a marriage ceremony that was performed there for two women. I know that Claire and Harriet, who I call Clariot, but it's so much more freeing. It's like not having to live in fear of being, you know, being truly and totally myself.
One of the things that I notice that happens is if you're a single person, you rarely get invited to events that are mostly couples. What about if you're a lesbian couple or a gay couple? Do people invite you to dinner parties?
Oh, yeah.
I guess they do. I'm single, and there's some of that goes on. But I don't think it's, well, I don't know.
I think it depends on who your circle of friends are. You know, when my partner and I first came to town, most of our friends were straight, and some of them were couples. And
so there's a lot of, at this point, gay, straight, socializing.
You know, oh, sure. Rainbow Vision's a beautiful microcosm of that, because it isn't exclusively LGBT. It is.
So you can be a straight person and retire and live out your life in Rainbow Vision?
Yeah, and we have great straight people living there, and everybody gets along. I think they self-select in, obviously. If they weren't comfortable being around people who were gay and lesbian, they wouldn't, you know, move there.
Right.
So they're wonderful people, and I think, and the community is really supportive and fun, and people, you know, the gays and lesbians are completely out and comfortable with their sexuality and their own humor and their life stories, and all the straight people there are supportive of that and share their own experiences. Two of my best friends there are a straight couple that what we share is theater. They have a theater background, I have a theater background, and so we're both great
and
friends.
Speaking of theater, the production by Rainbow Players is called Over the Hill, Under the Rainbow. Now, it's interesting how this is structured. It's not your typical monologue where one person tells their whole entire life story in 15 minutes, and then the next
right.
person goes. Each person tells about a page worth of material, and then it goes to another actor, mm-hmm. and then another person. And then you go back, and so the audience pieces together each person's story over the course of the production.
Correct.
Right, and it flows thematically. It begins with stories that we all wrote about our younger experiences, then through coming out, then after intermission, there's some very dramatic work about AIDS in the community. And then we talk about growing old, because the other thing we share in common in this group is that I think I'm the youngest at 61.
You're the baby.
I'm the baby,
yeah.
But everybody else is in their 60s, so.
Or 70s, or 80s.
Well, at Rainbow Vision, but not in the performance
group.
Oh, yeah.
Roger's 80.
Oh, he is. I didn't know that. See?
And I think one of the amazing things is that the importance of sexuality never seems to really go away.
Right. No matter how old you are.
Right.
Thank goodness.
We're talking to Chris Lynn and Jean Siminoff. Would you like to read some of your work?
Sure.
You want to go first?
Oh, sure. I'll go first because I'm older. I'll be 68 in September.
All right.
Okay. This piece is in the area of, well, you'll see it's about coming out. My mother and father welcomed me into their home with my lover, a woman 5'8" tall. My father was the tallest in his family at 5'6". My lover had blonde hair and blue eyes, unfamiliar to either side of my family. She had a straight English-German nose, a perfect profile. My parents said, "Welcome to our family." Okay, that's a lie. What is the truth is my mother put on sackcloth and ashes, tore her clothes. Who died, Mom? Our hopes died. What does that mean? I asked her. Grandchildren. No sooner had my mother completed her word than my father burst into tears. How could you, my mother shouted. How could I what? Do a sin against God. What's God got to do with it? He told me. Who? God? No, Bill, the Catholic drinking boy who wants to marry you, she said. Marry me? That's absurd. It was then that I burst into tears. He told us, my mother said. Told you? About her, my father finally said his first words. About her, I said. That shiksa, my mother stammered. Mom, I said, you don't even know her. To know her. I'll finish your sentence, my mother said, grinning, is to love her. I stood there. Then I stomped out of the room. For 10 years, I wanted to talk to my parents about this while Sue and I got on with our lives. Then I decided to take a leap of faith. Mom and Dad, do you love me? Of course we do. We just want to see you happy. Hadn't that been the statement I heard from so many of my friends and their coming out to their own parents? Mom and Dad, I am happy. They never stopped with a grandchild argument. And who knows? Had things been different back in the 60s, I might have had a child.
Jean Siminoff. Now, Chris Lynn, would you like to read one of your pieces?
Sure, and sort of along similar lines, but it's more about an unrequited love. Beth was my best friend. Her family was living on Forest Street when she was born, 1 month after I was born, But my family didn't move there until I was a year and a half old. She lived at 2034. I lived at 2035. On rainy summer days, we played dress-up in my attic or made up fanciful sci-fi adventures. On good days, our mothers kicked us out of the house and hid our Nancy Drew and Black Stallion books, so we would play softball or kickball in the street under the towering elms. More often, we would lie side by side on our backs on my lawn to watch the clouds or flip over and hunt for four-leaf clovers. When we fought, we would harumph off to our houses and refuse to speak until we couldn't stand it anymore and pretended it never happened. After we were older, we rounded up the smaller kids on the block and told them scary stories or created pretend families. We were the mom and dad. We took turns. Once, on one of Beth's teenage birthdays, I presented her gift as we sat on her bed and gossiped about the kids at the high school. I grabbed her and kissed her cheek hard and long. Was I too scared to reach round to her lips? She pushed me away. People will think we're a couple of fruits, she laughed. I'm sure I loved Beth, but I didn't have a roadmap and I never made the connection. The day I got married, Beth, a year away from her college degree in fashion, came over early and put the finishing touches on my dress and slip and my trousseau. We laughed till we cried over the idea of me, such a hippie, with a trousseau. My father stood at my side at the ceremony and said he was the one to give me away. But really, it was Beth.
Chris Lynn and Jean Siminoff are two of the Rainbow Players, and the production Over the Hill, Under the Rainbow takes place at the Silver Starlight Lounge at Rainbow Vision at 500 Rodeo Road on Sunday, the 20th of July at 7:30 in the evening. There's also going to be a performance in August, the 23rd of August, at the Unitarian Universalist Church. If people want more information, is there a number they can call?
Sure. Well, they could call you or me. They can call me. My number is 505-466-4622. Or if they need directions to get to Rainbow Vision, they can call 428-7777.
Jean Siminoff and Chris Lynn, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Marty Rosenberg. He is with Vintage and Rare. Well, he has an exhibition coming up at his gallery called Vintage and Rare Jazz Posters, and this is opening this Saturday, the 19th of July, from 2 to 5 in the afternoon at 901 Canyon Road. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Good to be back with you.
Now, it's an amazing collection that you have here, something I didn't even know existed, which is not only jazz. This is an exhibition of jazz posters. You also have music posters and all kinds of other cultural, artistic, classical music and so on posters. But the great, amazing thing is they're all from Poland. How did you start collecting posters from Poland?
Well, as many collectors began, it was pretty serendipitous. Almost 30 years ago, I was giving a speech in San Francisco, pursuing then a traditional business career, and an artist friend who was running a gallery on Union Street said, Marty, you really ought to take a look at some really interesting posters that the owners brought back from Eastern Europe in the early 70s. And she's a very avant-garde artist, and I really appreciated her insight. So I took a look, and I had just was kind of blown away because I was familiar with traditional French, Italian, Swiss advertising posters for products. But I had never seen designs like this, and I thought they were film and theater posters, but they were kind of mixed Polish with some American names, and I could see some directors, and I saw Fellini's name, and I saw the word Shakespeare, and I said, I wonder what these are. I've never seen anything like this. So I bought them, and I brought them back to Chicago and talked to some friends who were art directors at Leo Burnett, and I asked them the very naive question, have you ever heard or seen Polish posters before? You know, expecting some kind of funny retort. Well, the director of their art department said, Marty, you got to bring those in because we've been stealing their ideas out of the Graffi's annuals in our library since the 50s when they won all these international awards for design. we never have seen the posters, we've only seen some of the pictures. Well, that was the beginning.
What's amazing about these works of art, I mean, they really, you know, when you think of poster, you think of a reproduction, but these are in themselves works of art, and they are done by the Polish fine artists of their time, from the 50s on forward, who are, you know, oil painters and fine artists who studied it at academies and conservatories and so on.
Well, that's the unique story. In fact, we do have a film coming out called Freedom on the Fence, which will be out in September at film festivals, and it was took us 10 years to get this story together, and fortunately, we were able to interview some of these incredible art professors that you just, you know, referred to. The story begins at the end of World War II. And to make it, you know, kind of succinct and keep the mystery alive, the government, you know, Warsaw was leveled in World War II. And when the Germans left, they literally took down every wall and every building. So the city was devastated. And as the communists came in, and were wanting to rebuild some form of cultural life in this very depressed environment, the first thing they wanted to do is bring culture back to life. Well, culture requires promotion. Promotion requires handbills, flyers. Radio itself was pretty much devastated. And so how do you promote events? Well, you do it usually visually. And in about 1947, the government approached the two or three great professors and painters of the day. One was Henry Tomaszewski, who the New York Times did an enormous obituary on him when he died. And their goal was to convince the painters to do posters to help create this excitement in the streets. As they rebuilt the walls of the city, the walls became the showplace for art in the streets. And if they could convince the great painters, whom the public adored and recognized, to do posters, they could, you know, create a national culture. So to make that story short, it's a wonderful story. It's very inspirational. Tomaszewski led the way and said, we'll do posters for the government. We'll do a little propaganda for you, because you also want us to do that. But you can't restrict our artistic freedom. If we want to do Citizen Kane, or we want to do a poster for Gone with the Wind, or any of the other movies from all over the world that you want to bring in.
That were hardly socialist realism or whatever.
That's right. You have to let us create a new visual language. And it's going to be totally different. And you have to let us go. And that was the deal they struck. And so from...
And they bought it. They said, okay, you do some propaganda for us, then you've got carte blanche.
As long as the images were free, the artist said, you can control the words. And they didn't worry about the words, which was censored, because the words were titles of movies, Shakespeare, ballet, opera. And so the words were fine with them. In fact, the Polish artists were the first to integrate type style into the art form itself.
Very interesting.
So even the type became a composition and a visual language. So it was a very exciting beginning. And between
this was in the 50s?
Mid 40s. From 1948 to about late 70s, before Solidarity knocked the communists out of power, the Polish artists won more international design awards than any other country in the world, which is a great story. It's such an unknown piece of artistic history, arising out of the ashes, really, of a devastated country.
Well, I saw these posters that you are in the process of hanging at your gallery right now, and the opening is on Saturday from 2 to 5 in the afternoon at 901 Canyon Road. And they blow your mind. I mean, they're incredible works of art, and in so many different styles. And one of the things that I think is interesting to discuss is what was the connection that Polish artists and designers had to the rest of the world? Because, I mean, some of this stuff from the 60s looks like it's straight out of Yellow Submarine, and some of it looks like it's straight out of the Museum of Modern Art, you know, American artists in New York.
Well, in the early movement, which would be the 40s and early 50s, there was some exchange behind the Iron Curtain and countries like France. And so a few of the Polish painters, an artist named Granowski, actually studied with a very famous French poster artist, Cassandra, in Paris. And so there was this little bit of exchange back and forth. But the interesting phenomenon was the Polish School of Design, and there were two main academies, one in Warsaw and one in Krakow. And they merged with the architectural departments, and they created departments of visual art and design. And their goal was to create a new language in communication, influence, and seduction through posters. And they did not want to copy anything else. Their goal, and they were very dedicated to this, was that to rebuild and rebel against first the Germans, and then the Russians. This was a real rebellious art group. These were the rebels of what we might call, you know, the Haight-Ashbury days, or the
right.
or the hog farm days in Santa Fe in New Mexico. I mean, these were the seeds of jazz and the seeds of intellectual rebellion in the visual arts. And they wanted a new language, and they wanted it to be powerful, seductive, and not replicate any other medium styles that were in the world. So they didn't really want to copy or absorb.
But you know, as everybody knows, you can never rebel against something without showing what you're rebelling against in some way, even if it's the mirror image of it.
And they did have there's lots of symbolism. I think if you ask me, well, what are the things that these graphic artists and these painters were famous for? It was symbolism and metaphors. And so it was in the use of metaphors and symbols that they could caricature the communist system. And for example, when we we'll do a show on circus posters in the fall, you might see a very sinister looking clown with a giant red nose. Well, this was their way of poking fun at the communist system. Or today you looked in the gallery at a theater piece called The Mannequin's Ball, and it shows this very transparent couple, obviously a very wealthy bureaucratic couple, and you can almost see right through them dancing. And then in the background there's a painting. But when you look close at the painting, you see that the painting is a huge fist with a thumb over the tops of the fingers, which was a solidarity symbol for everything's going to be okay. So they got through the censors all kinds of wonderful anti-communist political metaphors, but they also use that in their movie posters, their Shakespeare, their opera.
Now, were the censors, like, I mean, wanting to censor them, but they'd cut the deal so they couldn't, or were they so clever that they didn't notice, or?
Both. I think they were very clever artists, and the censors were looking for the obvious, and they also didn't want to discourage and get into conflict with the art community that was producing this work, because some of these were now very famous artists. So it was kind of a little bit of a game. I guess I'd call it a censorship game. So there is some fascinating symbolism, but they also introduced this confluence of history, government, and culture and economics. They realized that in a poster you have about 2 seconds. I mean, if you think of our world, we don't have kiosks in the streets. Typically, we have billboards. And in Poland, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, all along the boulevards were these kiosks, which permitted posters to be displayed for all of the cultural events. So in our film, in the archival footage that we have, you can really see how the art of the streets was so powerful. But if you watch the crowds walk by, you realize that a real originally designed poster has about 2 seconds to grab you, stop you, tell you what its content is, and then the most important thing is, can it influence you to act? Which is, are you going to go to the theater?
Right.
So how they accomplished that was the most famous artists built their whole careers around recognition. You'll know my surrealism, you'll know my abstract, you'll know my melodic, lyrical art. And when you see that image flashing before you, you're going to stop and look at it.
We're talking to Marty Rosenberg. Now, this poster exhibition that you're doing is jazz posters. You also have other kinds of posters there. But this one is a benefit for the Friends of Santa Fe Jazz.
Yes, one of our wonderful institutions here, headed by Lee Burke and Susan Burke, who've brought so much to the city. And this is an organization that has brought some of the emerging and fine jazz musicians to our city through some through concerts that they sponsor. And I've always wanted to do a really large jazz exhibition. And we did one in Chicago, but this is six times the size. We're going to have over 150 original jazz posters on display at the gallery a benefit. And the whole month, a percentage of all the sales go to Friends of Santa Fe Jazz.
Now, did Duke Ellington and Billie Holiday and Charles Mingus and all these people actually go to Poland? And I guess they must have.
Well, the earliest, I'm not a jazz expert on Poland, but I did learn enough having looked now at this part of our collection. I did learn that Dave Brubeck visited Poland, Warsaw, in about 1958, and he was kind of their first cool jazz musician. In the pre-war period, they say the 40s, the jazz was really in the restaurants and the bars, and it was mostly kind of swing jazz. And then when World War II ended, the communists came in, and they suppressed totally any kind of swing jazz music.
Which is so amazing. What did they think it would do? Make people feel capitalist?
Well, I can quote from one author who described the period that the government saw jazz, and I quote, as an oral poison from depraved Western nations. So it gives you an idea of the venom with which the communist restrictiveness was imposed on their society. So in the post-war period, the Poles went underground, and I think they called it the catacomb period, and jazz was in private homes. Behind closed doors, there were no flyers. It had to be word of mouth. In the 50s, Stalin died, and that thawed the environment of restrictiveness a notch or two. And so outside jazz musicians, for the first time, got into the country, and I think Brubeck was among the first. And also in the 50s, the first jazz magazine behind the Iron Curtain was produced, and it was produced in Poland. Ironically, Poland also produced the first international poster biennale in the world in 1966, and I have been involved with the Poster Dealers Association for about 20 years, and I can tell you that even my wonderful colleagues from all over the world who deal in international posters, 9 out of 10 of them would not know that for 10 years, Poland was the home of the International Poster Biennale, where all the great artists of the world brought their posters for juried competition. And the director of it was Professor Morozak from the Krakow Academy of Fine Arts. So this the story gets, as you weave it together, it keeps growing.
And I wish we had more time to tell it, but it's actually time to go. Marty Rosenberg's collection of vintage original posters is hosting the exhibition Great Jazz Posters on July 19th, which is Saturday. The opening is from 2 to 5, and the exhibition runs through the 15th of August. It's at 901 Canyon Road, right at Canyon Road and Palace Avenue. For more information, 577-7419. You can also go to mrposter.com. Marty Rosenberg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.